Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go over to 1517.org/podcast and check out all the things that are going on over there. You can also, while you're there, if you want to support the podcast, the blog, the events, academy, with the insane amount of students getting free education over there, all the things that go on over 1517 and Christ Hold Fast, you can become a supporter, because it's all made possible by people who are partnering up. So you can go to the donate page, you can become a monthly supporter of any amount, all of it helps. And if you have done that and you are a supporter, thank you very much. You do make all of this stuff possible. Chad, how's it going, man?
It's going good. I've had a fun morning. I've been diving into this kind of crazy character named Balaam that we're about to get to, and discovered a few things I didn't know already. So I'm primed and ready.
Yeah, well, Balaam is definitely some kind of weird number sideshow that goes on. Yeah.
Surprising things about Balaam is how often he comes up in the rest of the Bible too. I was doing a word search just on his name, and of course he features prominently in the chapters we're about to cover in Numbers, but he comes up again in Deuteronomy, in Joshua, in Nehemiah, in Micah, and then two places in the New Testament. I mean, it's pretty unusual that this character who kind of comes out of nowhere continues to be talked about all the way to the book of Revelation. I mean, so that kind of tells you how significant he becomes in the ongoing story of the scriptures.
Yeah, and not in an overwhelmingly positive way.
No, I mean, there is a certain ambiguity about him, which is fascinating, which we'll get to in a minute. But yeah, most of the time he's like, you don't want your son to grow up to be like Balaam.
Yeah, it's sort of a bummer of a guy that, when you think about being penned and marked in, you know, the most read book of all time, he doesn't have a great showing.
No, he does not. Yeah, especially when you get to the New Testament, when in 2 Peter talks about him, or in the letters to the seven churches in Revelation. Yeah, Balaam is certainly not a model to emulate. He becomes one of those characters, you know, like we will talk about, you know, Hitler or Mussolini or whoever it might be, like the bad guy. They kind of become the stock characters representing evil, and Balaam kind of becomes that in the scriptural story.
Yeah, I've thought about things like that with Pilate, who just gets to be one of two people mentioned in the creed. It's Mary, who of course is mentioned in a very positive way. And then Pilate, he's famous for these words, suffered under Pontius Pilate. And then for centuries, the church confesses that he was there and he was in charge. Just what a bummer.
Yeah, yeah. I could be wrong on this, but I'm thinking it's in Jesus Christ Superstar. There's a scene, anyway, there's a scene in a play where Pilate's wife, the dream that she had that troubled her so much, was that in the dream she heard throughout the centuries the confession of the creed, suffered under Pontius Pilate.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, it's not a... Yeah, what do you think about it? Every day, or certainly every Sunday, for centuries, in churches around the world, your name is invoked as the one under whom the Messiah suffered.
Yeah.
Not a great legacy.
Yeah, you become renowned as persecutor of God. That's a bummer.
Yeah. Not the reputation you want. All right, so let's get back here to where the story all begins. So we're in Numbers 22, and the story of Balaam takes us through three chapters. It's chapter 22, 23, and 24 are all about Balaam. And the basic story is, if you don't remember it, is that Balaam is hired as a prophet or seer to come curse Israel. And the beginning of the story is how the Moabite king tries to hire him and eventually gets him there. And then the rest of the account circles around four different oracles that Balaam delivers, kind of these poetic, I don't know what you'd call them, something like poetic, sermonic speeches, I guess, oracles, I guess is the technical term for it, where he talks about Israel just as they are, and Israel as they will be, and as we'll as we'll see when we get to the last chapter, the last oracle, he even prophesies the rise of a star out of Jacob, which traditionally has been interpreted as a messianic prophecy. So it's one of those weird ironies that you have in the Bible where this guy who ends up with that bad rap we've been talking about also is the one who utters a prophecy about the Messiah. So God does indeed work in mysterious ways. So that's kind of the overall picture that we're going to be looking at. Now, so I will say one thing about Balaam before we get into the biblical story, and this is one of the things I was looking at this morning. I knew in the back of my mind that there had been an archaeological discovery that in some way featured Balaam, but I couldn't remember the details. So I was looking at that this morning. If you're interested, you can check it out for yourself. The gist of it is that in 1967, there was an archaeological dig going on at a place in modern-day Jordan. And they discovered a plastered wall, which probably was part of some sort of pagan temple complex at one point. The walls collapsed due to probably to an earthquake. But there's a multitude, and by multitude, I mean like hundreds of fragments that are still there on the wall that they were able to piece back together. The original ink was in black and some of the letters were in red. Which is kind of funny because we still do that in our Bibles today, you know, the words of Christ in red. So I don't know if these were like some of the words of Balaam were in red and the others were in black. I don't know, but I guess that tradition goes way back. Anyway, enough of the inscription remains to where the story is kind of pieced together to where on the wall of this temple, there was this long oracle prophecy by a guy named Balaam, son of Beor, which is the exact language we have here in the book of Numbers, who was a prophet, who was a seer, and he had this vision of an upcoming famine that was inflicted upon the peoples of that region by one of the pagan deities. And it is, of course, there's some dispute as to exactly how everything is to be translated to piece back together, but that's the gist of it. And I think they date the inscription to around the 8th or 9th century. You can read the article for yourself, get the dates on there. But anyway, it's fascinating because the name and the father's name and the job of Balaam are all the same, both in the scriptures as well as in this archaeological find. So pretty neat when we can see how, I mean, this, not that it proves the Bible, but there's like this parallel between this scriptural story, this archaeological story. So for those of you who like that kind of stuff, you can check it out.
Yeah, it's interesting to be sort of a generic prophet seer for hire, because this guy isn't prophet in the sense of he's not like overtly, you know, Jewish or something. You know, this is just a guy that will tell you what is coming. That is interesting. And oddly enough, just this morning, as we were getting ready for this, in my Facebook feed, somehow, I guess it was a promoted post or something like that, this guy pops up who is almost exactly that. It was essentially him talking about how he's got this prophetic insight to 2019. And that he would like to come out to your church to give it to you.
Wow.
And he's putting himself out there for hire to give this sort of like to this prophetic word. And I was like, and to speak about what is coming. And that was ironic because of, I had Balaam kind of thoughts going through my head. And I thought, look at this guy. Like, and then I thought about what we just talked about, how in the New Testament, you're expressly told, like, don't be like that. You know? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, wow, this guy's sort of being just like that. I guess there's still, let me
one,
speak
one
about what's
One can only
happen.
Hope that when this guy comes to visit your church, he won't fly or drive there, but we'll ride on his donkey.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's one of those nothing new under the sun kind of situations, right? Where there's there's always a contemporizing of biblical stories in one way or another. And I mean, that's a great example of somebody trying to do exactly that, tell you the future for payment.
Yeah.
You give him the money, he'll consult God and tell you what God says.
I'm sure he fancies himself a Samuel, but it struck me as a little more Balaam-ish.
More Balaam, yeah, exactly. Well, that, I mean, that is kind of what Balaam was. I mean, it's like when you're reading parts of the story, he actually comes across as a legit guy. I mean, repeatedly he refers to not just to God, but actually to Yahweh. I mean, he uses the divine name and even calls him his God. So this is a non-Israelite, obviously, who believes in the true God. And also he's got some sort of prophetic gift, or at least he's one to whom God speaks in dreams, because, I mean, undoubtedly this is God speaking to him and through him. So I can't think of anybody else in the scriptures that is like this. I mean, we do have occasions elsewhere, well, actually in Genesis, where God speaks to non-Israelites in a dream. Abimelech is one, and then Laban is another one. So certainly God can do that. Well, and Pharaoh as well. Of course, Joseph interpreted those dreams. So God can speak and reveal himself to non-Israelites in dreams.
Well, it seems like I would assume that we would credit this to God, but it would seem like that's what happens with Pilate's wife.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, and it's pretty well known that this is happening, or at least this seems to be happening, in some parts of the world among followers of Islam. I mean, there's a lot of, I mean, when I say a lot, I'm talking about widespread, numerous accounts of Muslims who have had dreams where Christ appears to them and tells them go to church, basically. And these are not isolated. These happen in lots of different places, and the people actually end up going to church, and many of them become followers of Christ. So it's not an unprecedented phenomenon for God to speak to non-believers or non-Israelites, or those outside the church, in such a way that he reveals to them his will. It might make some people uncomfortable, but that is the truth, at least biblically speaking. It does happen. So anyway, Balaam is that kind of unusual character. And he enters the story when Israel is still in what we call the Transjordan. That is the area to the east of the Jordan River. And he is hired by, or at least he's attempted to be, they attempt to hire him, the king of Moab does. His name is Balak, or Balak, however you want to pronounce that that name. And the Moabite king is basically living in fear of the Israelites. Like many of the peoples around there, he's heard what God has done for the Israelites and bringing them out of Egypt and giving them victory over the forces that were arrayed against them. And so verse 3 says that Moab was in great fear because of the Israelites, because they were numerous, and says Moab was in dread of the sons of Israel. So they're living in fear because of this enemy, even though there's no evidence whatsoever that Israel intended to attack them. Israel was interested in passing over the Jordan River to go to the Promised Land. But they're afraid of the Israelites, and they don't think that they'll be able to defeat them militarily unless they're weakened.
Well, the Israelites did just defeat two kings back to back.
One of the giant Og, right?
So, yeah, I mean, like, if there was some force of people that, like, you know, took out, you know, I don't know, they took out Canada and Mexico, and they were like, well, they haven't expressly said they were coming for us, but there's cause for concern.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, they're close. They're on their way, and chances are, what's going to happen to our the people around us is going to happen to us too. So yeah, I mean, I think rationally the fear is justified. But what's interesting, though, is the tactic that is pursued by the Moabites. Rather than allying themselves with other peoples around there to form a greater force by which they can attack and hopefully defeat Israel, instead they take a religious approach. So they send messengers who lived a long way off, and the messengers say that, you know, this people, they came out of Egypt, they're covering the whole land, they're living opposite us. And then in verse 6, it says, "Now therefore, please come and curse this people for me, since they are too mighty for me. Perhaps I may be able to defeat them and drive them out of the land, because I know that he whom you bless," he's talking to Balaam here, "he whom you bless is blessed, and he whom you curse is cursed." So that's the basic message that they deliver to Balaam. Hey, basically, we know that you're a real powerful seer, and we have an issue here with these Israelites. And so what we want you to do is come and do what you do best, because, hey, whatever you, the blessing you utter is going to be a blessing, and the curse that you utter is going to be a curse. So they show up. The first time, there are two trips. They show up the first time and they give this message to Balaam. And basically, Balaam tells them, okay, let me sleep on it. You stay here. And in the morning, I'm going to come back and I'll bring back to you whatever word the Lord said to me. And so they all went to bed. And that night, it says that God came to Balaam. You know, God has this way of starting conversations with a question. He does it all the way back in Eden, you know, Adam, where are you? And in this case, God says to Balaam, "Who are these men with you?" And Balaam answers him and he says, "Well, you know, Balak, the king of Moab, sent these messengers, and here's what they had to say." And God responds to Balaam and says, "Don't go with them. You shall not curse the people because they are blessed." So that's God's first response. Basically, a big fat no. Don't go with them. Don't say anything. Don't even attempt to curse them, because listen, they're blessed, and there's nothing you're going to be able to do that's going to alter that blessing. So, I mean, so far, everything we're hearing about Balaam is good, because what he does is he gets up in the morning, he goes back to these representatives, and he tells them to go home. He says, "Go back to your land, because the Lord," and that is in Hebrew, that is Yahweh, that is the divine name, "because the Lord has refused to let me go with you." So, first attempt was a failure. So these guys go back to the king of Moab and they tell him, well, they edit the story a bit. It's interesting because they don't say everything that Balaam told them. They don't say that God appeared to Balaam and he said this and told us this and then sent us home. Instead, all they tell the king is Balaam refused to come with us. So they kind of they simplify the response. Perhaps they didn't want to make the king angry. But the Moabite king is not going to take no for an answer, because he sent some leaders this time. Originally sent messengers. Now he sends leaders, more of them, in fact, and more distinguished than the others that he sent. So he's upping the ante now. He's sending his top guys, and they come to Balaam, and they say this time, more or less the same thing: "Let nothing hinder you from coming." And then here's the real kicker, verse 17. He says, "For I will indeed," this is the Moabite king speaking through the messengers, "for I will indeed honor you richly, and I will do whatever you say to me. Please come then and curse this people for me." And again, so far, Balaam is looking like a good guy, because listen to his answer. This is verse 18. "Though Balak were to give me his house full of silver and gold, I could not do anything, either small or great, contrary to the command of the Lord my God." I mean, that's phenomenal. I mean, you could alter the name, you know, put, instead of Balak, put in somebody else's name or some other group or whatever it might be, and put that in the mouth of a pastor today or a believer today to be like, hey, that's a very faithful, pious God-fearing child of God, right?
Yeah, that sounds like some Luther, here I stand, I can do no other talk.
Yeah, right. Yeah, offer me whatever you want. I mean, you can give me your whole house full of silver and gold, but it's not going to change anything. So that's the offer. That's a response. And it's a repeat of the first time. He says, well, all right, let me sleep on it. You stay here tonight, and I'm going to find out what God says to me. So same thing, verse 20, God came to Balaam at night, and he gives a different response this time. This is pretty fascinating. He says to Balaam, if the men have come to call you, rise up and go with them, but only the word which I speak to you shall you do. All right? So God seemed to be saying, the men have come, so I want you to go with them. But here's the kicker. You only tell them what I tell you. All right, so what happens? Well, this time, Balaam gets up in the morning, and he gets ready to go. He puts a saddle on his donkey, and he heads out with the leaders of Moab. And then we have this surprising verse, verse 22. But God was angry because he was going. And the angel of the Lord took his stand in the way as an adversary against him. Now he was riding on his donkey, and his two servants were with him. So this is kind of interesting, because on the one hand, God in the dream says, go, but only speak the word that I tell you to. And then like a verse later, it says God was angry because he was going, and the Lord's angel stood in his way. What do you think is going on there?
Yeah, I'll be completely honest. Like, I mean, the typical interpretation of this event is that God was upset that Balaam inquired a second time. Mm-hmm. That he asked him the same thing, which he had already given his answer to, as if God was, you know, going to change his mind. You know, maybe it's, you know, hey, apparently, you know, God doesn't like it if you strike the rock two times. He doesn't like it if you ask if you should go curse the people two times. I suppose that's made, unless you got something better, I guess that's the best interpretation. In my mind, I am just like, this doesn't make any sense.
That is complete honesty.
Yeah, I'll just be completely honest. I mean, I guess that interpretation, it's speculative, and you're saying, like, you know, here's why God is upset. Maybe it is. It doesn't say that that's why he's upset, so we couldn't know for sure. But other than that, yeah, I just don't know what's going on here.
No, and I'll admit the same thing. It is a bit jarring. I mean, these are verse 20. And then verse 22. So there's one verse in between where God says, if the men have come to call you, rise up and go with them. But God was angry because he was going. So yeah, it's kind of a jarring juxtaposition. So I'm sure somebody out there has completely figured it out. They'll be able to,
yeah, sure,
to help us out.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, you know, if you go with that interpretation, like, if it is true that Balaam is sort of dropping hints that he could be bribed into this or whatever. And I mean, God of course knows this, and that he's irritated about it, and that Balaam would then go to him a second time and say, you know, hey, you know, should I go do this thing? These guys have come, and God is essentially at that point saying, you know, like, do what you want to do. And we'll see what happens. Like, I already said no, and now you can, like, come up against me, and then we'll see who wins. Mm-hmm. I suppose that could all work. You know, that God, that Balaam does want to do it, or he's willing to do it if he can get something out of it, and God knows it, and he's not happy about it. I suppose that's all true because God would obviously know that, but it's not explicit in the text.
No, yeah, I think that. You've kind of put the point well there. There's something that you have to kind of extrapolate from this. There's nothing that's explicit in the text as to why there's this sudden shift. So whatever it was, we'll just kind of have to leave that for now, I suppose. Whatever it was, God was angry because he was going. And we enter into one of the, in my opinion, one of the funniest stories in the Bible. I mean, there's a lot of humor in the scriptures, but it's pretty hard to beat this particular story. I mean, this this whole thing has been arranged, has been written, I think anyway, as a comedy. If you look at the details in this story and the contrast between the donkey and Balaam, I don't think there's any other way that you can read it. I've even heard this the story described as a kind of a biblical burlesque, sort of a poking fun and the biblical way of making us laugh at the stupidity of those who rebel against the will of God. So however you want to describe it, it certainly is funny, because what happens is three different times as Balaam is riding his donkey along, the donkey, as donkeys are wont to do, stubbornly goes his own way, follows his own will, because he sees this angel of the Lord standing in front of him, not just standing there, but he's got a drawn sword in his hand. It seemed like the angels in the Bible are always packing, like they yeah. they've always got a sword, they've always got a weapon ready to go. So the first time, the donkey turns off into a field, and Balaam hits the donkey to get her back in the way she's supposed to be going. And the second time, they're by these vineyards, and there's a wall on either side of them. I presume in this day and time, it would have been a rock wall of some sort. And so the donkey's walking along, and she again sees the angel of the Lord, and this time she smashes Balaam's leg foot against the wall. So he hits her again. By now, I'm sure he's thoroughly embarrassed because of his recalcitrant donkey, who just won't listen to what he has to say, which is part of the humor here. And then finally, the third time the donkey sees the angel, she just lays down. She just won't go any further. She lays down into Balaam. So Balaam, by now, of course, he's furious. And he takes his stick and he starts beating on the donkey. So this whole thing is funny for a number of reasons. But now it's about to get the humor of it is about to be revealed to us, because verse 28, it says that God opened the mouth of the donkey and she speaks to Balaam. She says, "What have I done to you that you have struck me these three times?" Now, that's funny, a donkey talking. But I think it's even funnier that Balaam actually responds.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's one thing to hear a donkey talk, but rather than just standing there dumbfounded, unable to speak, Balaam actually engages in dialogue with this donkey. So he says a response in answer, "Because you've made a mockery of me. If there had been a sword in my hand, I would have killed you by now." And the donkey responds, "Am I not your donkey, on which you've ridden all your life to this day? Have I ever been accustomed to do so to you?" And Balaam answers, "Well, no." And at that point, God opens the eyes of Balaam, and he, too, sees the angel of the Lord standing there with his drawn sword. And then to kind of wrap up the story, well, there's more to it. We'll stop there for a second. Okay, so there's a lot of irony that's built into this. One is, okay, you kind of got to picture the scene. This professional prophet has been hired because his word is powerful, right? Whoever he blesses is blessed, whoever he curses is cursed. And yet, he can't even, by his word, control his own donkey.
Yeah, yeah. And he's supposed to go and... He's a seer, right? He's a seer who can't see.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he's blind, right? His donkey can see what he is blind to.
Yeah, this is not good for your. You assume that is he with these guys? I mean, the guys just go with them? Is he by himself? Has he got these guys with him? I mean, like, are they like bearing witness to this scene where You know, they're like, maybe we should hire the donkey.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm assuming all they're observing this, which is probably why he's so angry. Well, verse 29, he says, because you made a mockery of me, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, how embarrassing. You know, the guy can't control his donkey. He's wandering off into the field and smashing his leg and just lays down in the way. This prophet has got some issues. So, yeah, and once everybody observes what's going on, then maybe they were thinking, we hired the wrong person. Yeah. Let's see if the donkey will do the cursing for us. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of irony that's built into us. His word is ineffective against a donkey. So if he tries to curse Israel, you know, fat chance of that happening. And he's supposed to be a seer, but he's blind. In fact, he can't even see as well as his own donkey can see, not just physically, but even in the spiritual realm. And then there's just the added humor of, you know, a donkey talking and engaging in conversation with a prophet. So let's pick up the story. This is when the angel of the Lord begins to speak. And the angel says to him, why have you struck your donkey these three times? Behold, I have come out as an adversary because your way was contrary to me. So whatever was going on with Balaam, maybe it was in his plan, his intention. We don't know, but whatever was going on with him, he was not planning on doing the Lord's will, no matter what, contrary to what he may have told the messengers. And verse 33, it says, the donkey saw me. This is the angel of the Lord speaking. The donkey saw me and turned aside from me these three times. If she had not turned aside, I would surely have killed you just now and let her live. So after hearing all this, Balaam responds. He says, I have sinned because I did not know that you were standing in the way against me. Now then, if it is displeasing to you, I will turn back, which is probably the smartest thing that Balaam has said so far. Listen, if you don't want me to go, I'll go home. He realizes at this point that his neck is on the line. He is not in the safest of situations. So turning back sounds probably like a pretty good option at this point. But the angel says to him, go with the men, but you shall speak only the word which I shall tell you. Now, the more that we look at this and the more I hear kind of how the angel is responding to him, the more I wonder if the reason that there is that shift between God saying go and then God being angry because he was going was because there was something going on in Balaam's mind that God knew about that he was not happy with. Like, he was going to go, but he had this sort of sinister plot that he was considering whereby he was going to say what he wanted to say rather than what God had given him to say.
Or say what the king wants to hear.
Yes, say what the politician wants to hear. So, he offers to go back. The angel says to, no, go and speak only the word, which I tell you. So that's what Balaam does. He goes along with the leaders that Balak had sent. And then verse 36, he arrives there. At first, the king is upset. He says, listen, I urgently sent to you to get here. So why didn't you come? Am I really unable to honor you? So this is the king who's basically mad because he feels like he's been dishonored by this prophet because he had to send people twice to get him to come. And Balaam basically just ignores his anger, which is probably the best approach to take. He says, look, I'm here now, right? I'm standing in front of you. So am I able to speak anything at all? He asks. The word that God puts in my mouth, that I shall speak. So that's his response to his response to the king. You know, I was thinking about this whole story this morning, and you know, one of the things that struck me is you know, that if we apply this today, there's always going to be those who stand in opposition to to Israel, right? And by Israel, I mean the people of God. So I'm not talking about a nation. I'm talking about the church, the new Israel. There's always going to be those who stand in opposition to it, who are, for one reason or another, afraid of the church, maybe afraid because of the influence of the church or the message of the church or whatever it might be. So they're, and one way or another, they're living in fear, and they're willing to resort to just about anything to weaken the church. And I've seen this happen where very often it seems like there's sort of a Chicken Little approach that even Christians will voice, like the sky is falling, like, oh, things are so terrible for the church, being attacked on all sides, and all doom and gloom, and the end is near, and the sky is falling, and other sorts of what we call catastrophizing, where everything is just a terrible catastrophe. And stories like this, I think, are essential for listening to in times like that, because they point to the fact that, listen, it doesn't matter what kind of powerful leaders might be against the people of God, who they might hire to attempt to work harm against the people of God, even if those who are hired intend to do evil against the people. It really doesn't matter, because in the end, the people of God are God's people. They're His church, and nothing and no one is going to be able to go against them, to do them any kind of significant, lasting harm, because they're safe in Christ. They're safe in the one who's made him his own.
Yeah, so you're not strictly speaking of like the Palestine-Israel conflict.
Yeah, no. No, I don't think I'm talking about that at all.
Yeah.
No, but, you know, whatever the conflict might be against the powers of evil, that the spiritual forces in the heavenly realms that Paul talks about, well, they can't work any ultimate harm to the church, because, the like Christ says, the gates of hell itself can't prevail against it.
Well, this goes to, I've heard it said before that the church has only ever grown.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it appears like it's, you know, people will say that, you know, the church attendance is down and this sort of stuff. But when you're talking about the church and those who have come before us, those who have died, the church has only ever had members added to it.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
Yeah. So
yeah,
baptisms continue to happen, and people are continue to be brought in, and so you might say that our church is shrinking or something like this, but the church has only ever grown since its inception.
Yeah, yeah. The body of Christ isn't losing fingers or toes or arms. It continues to expand.
Exactly. And that's 40 minutes. Well, we've got more with Balaam. It'd be real weird if that was just the end of the story.
Yeah, it would be. Yeah, we got two more chapters to go, so yeah. Hang in there.
Yeah, it's
tune in again.
It's weird enough, even with all three of them. So don't worry. Don't think. Oh man, wow, what a weird excursion. It's not quite that weird. We got a little more to talk about, and we will get to it next week. We'll see you then, Chad.
All right. See you then. Thanks.